First, I want you to meet Professor Paul Wenberg. Paul, what do you do?
So my research group builds instruments that fly on airplanes to measure atmospheric composition, and we're currently involved in a big NASA campaign to study air quality over a number of cities in Southeast Asia.
Why would NASA be interested in that?
NASA has been building sensors for space, of course. That's its primary activity. And as part of that, the South Koreans got out ahead of the rest of the world in building a spacecraft that could monitor air quality in exquisite detail in what's called geostationary orbit, meaning it sits over Southeast Asia. NASA just launched its own such sensor. And so this activity that has begun over many years ago now is to try to understand how to integrate observations that you make from the ground, from airplanes, and from space to understand air quality and how to improve air quality over cities.
Paul Wenberg is at Caltech, a campus where what seems simple turns out to be deeply, even wonderfully sophisticated. That straightforward measurement of air quality is basic to planning a real attempt to solve the global climate challenge.
We certainly find that until you go out and measure things, it's very difficult to make predictions about either what's happened in the past or what's happening in the future. And I think climate science is one of those key fields where observationally driven science has been really critical for understanding the fate of Earth. And towards that, the other major activity in my research group has been observations of greenhouse gases in Earth's atmosphere. So I've been involved in a number of missions to study composition of greenhouse gases over the world using remote sensing from space and from the ground.
Where I was last year, San Diego, I talked to Ralph Keeling, who is the son of Dave, who produced the Keeling Curve, which was doing something which seemed to be just pure science, but it turns out to be absolutely crucial. And I think you know the Keelings.
Yeah, so David Keeling, the father now, invented the measurement of CO2 in the atmosphere. You could measure with sufficient precision to observe changes in CO2. And he did it to try to understand the interaction of atmospheric carbon dioxide with fresh waters. It was really a rather minimalist idea about why one would do this. But quickly, his vision expanded to understanding global climate change. And so beginning in the geophysical year, Keeling established a network of observations that today we now call the Keeling Curve, which observe the increasing abundance of CO2 in the air. What's interesting is that the CO2 that's been increasing comes from burning of fossil fuels. So when the fossil fuels are burned, you consume oxygen because you convert, say, a carbon-carbon bond into two CO2 molecules. And so the son, Ralph Keeling, who I was working with when I was a student at Harvard, invented the first machine to measure the oxygen going down as a result of the combustion of CO2. The cool thing about this is that while a lot of the carbon dioxide that is going into the atmosphere ends up going into the ocean eventually, the oxygen doesn't, because oxygen is just sparingly soluble in ocean water. And so you can observe by the fact that the oxygen is going down faster than the CO2 is going up, you can observe how much of the fossil fuels that we emit end up going into the ocean. We don't have to worry about running out of oxygen to breathe, but through this exquisite observation of how much oxygen is in the air, you can actually see what we are doing to the atmosphere.
And how are you applying these measurements?
We've been working on two different aspects. First of all, is just how does climate interact with the biosphere? So I mentioned the CO2 goes into the ocean. It also goes into the plants and to the soil. And currently, about half of the CO2 that we emit into the atmosphere ends up going into either the ocean or the biosphere. And what we're trying to understand then is how are the forests and the trees evolving as the climate changes? Will this service that they're doing, taking up a lot of CO2, continue into the future? So we've been studying in particular the northern forests, and this is a large swath of forests that extend across between 45 degrees north latitude and 70 latitude. These forests do not exist in the southern hemisphere because that's the southern ocean.
And of course, you've got up, including Canada, vast forests, but they're not really lapping up the CO2 and flourishing because there are other effects of climate change, including the pests, the worms, and God knows what else.
Yeah, the last big aircraft campaign we did to study atmospheric composition was to look at the fires of the Western North America. And it is actually true. Large swaths of Canada burned this last summer as a result of both very dry conditions and the degraded forest.
And also, to some extent, even though CO2 is something that plants use, you've got to have nutritional aspects in the soil. Otherwise, they don't grow because you don't just have one element.
Yeah, it's exactly true. Nitrogen, phosphate, there's a number of other ingredients that make up biomass. But a critical aspect of the northern ecology is that the climate is changing incredibly fast. So while there's been significant global warming, this year is about 1.5 degrees warmer, say, than pre-industrial, the warming is amplified over land and amplified even further over the northern land. And as a result of that, these forests are experiencing a very, very rapid change in the climate. And that's leaving behind a lot of the trees. In other words, if you look at where needleleaf trees grow, they tend to grow in colder places. And so a lot of these forests are composed of needleleaf trees. But as the climate is warming, those trees are becoming less and less able to survive and, in fact, lead to these large conflagration that we've observed over the last few years.
So being a professor in this place, Caltech, for you involves about 10 fields of different aspects of science.
It's a wonderful thing about Caltech. We're a very small institution, as you know. What that means is that you just talk to lots of different people who don't do exactly what you do, but you realize that you have things that you could do together and problems that you didn't even know existed that can be solved through these interactions with, say, data scientists or chemists or others. So it's a wonderful place to be a scientist.
You just cross the campus and there is the world expert on this as well. But going back to the atmosphere and the rubbish you often get, especially around Southeast Asia, where some countries, without naming them, you can barely breathe. How much is that, the particles in the atmosphere, the rubbish up there, affecting their own local climate?
So it's a very interesting and complicated answer. Particles in the air, on average, tend to actually cool the surface below them. That is to say, they reflect away enough sunlight that they can make the surface cooler than it would be without the particles. And this is actually one of the biggest challenges in understanding the past climate change, is the role of these small particles. How much have they offset the warming that comes from the increasing greenhouse gases? Because it's very clear that aerosol pollution is going down. It's hard to believe it, but over Southeast Asia and over China in particular, the amount of particles in the air has been going down very, very quickly as they install the same kinds of technologies that you would find in Australia and the United States and Europe that minimize the pollution coming from, say, automobiles. And so as a result, as the air over the cities becomes cleaner, it results in amplified warming. And so this idea that there's always co-benefits, that if we somehow clean up the industry, we're going to also help the climate, doesn't always play out that way.
Okay, finally, a $64,000 question. If you get to a point, which seems to be getting closer and closer, where you think the climate's getting out of control, we have to do something drastic. Geoengineering. So instead of waiting for the volcano to give us a blanket instead of the pollution, we put up stuff there, sulfates, who knows, imitating volcanic explosions. Would you be for or against that if the crunch comes?
So I've been involved in a lot of discussions around just this question. And I was involved in a big National Academy of Sciences report that came out just a few years ago. And the consensus of that report, and it reflects my own view, is that these are technologies that we really need to study to understand the potential for harm reduction and also the potential risks associated with these. You get into all sorts of questions around diplomacy, who gets to control the knob. It's just an incredibly difficult question. But there's no doubt in my mind that we need to consider and understand these technologies because they may offer a temporary avenue for harm reduction, particularly in areas of the world right now that are suffering the largest impacts from climate change, but also have little resources to mitigate those and adapt to those changes.
Yeah, the problem is some of the experiments where they'd be on very, very small scale were blocked because people said it's too much of a risk.
Yeah, it is definitely controversial. But I think this is why a unified research program from many, many nations is really essential, because otherwise we will run in just exactly to what you mentioned, that it's very difficult to do experiments. And so there's also a lot that can be done without actually doing experiments. We know a lot about the potential of these technologies through volcanoes that you mentioned. And so there's lots that can be done to study how these technologies might work absent a large-scale deployment.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome, Robin.
Professor Paul Wenberg is an atmospheric scientist at Caltech in Pasadena.